You're watching Channel 37. WHXN. New Salem.
After a totally planned in advance hiatus that was in no way tied to anyone's mental illness, Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show is back. This time around, we prove that sequels are double the quality with Grease 2. After that, it's Eric Stoltz's secret villain origin story. Hold me back for Surf 2.
Hello and welcome to Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. I'm Dan, and with me are Wendy.
Hey there.
Dave.
Hello.
And Will.
No human I know could eat like that and still surf.
It is true. Oh, Johnny Big Head, we hardly knew you. Wendy, you came to us with a movie this week. What did you bring to us?
Grease 2.
Oh, this is going to be a wonderful year, Blanche.
Oh, wonderful.
Spending my vacation in the summer sun. Getting lots of action, having lots of fun. Scoring like a bandit to the bumblebee.
Qualities. Well, I'm not waiting anymore.
Here she is.
Well,
we're gonna be late. Let's go.
Geometry and history is just a pain. Biology and chemistry destroys my brain. Well, don't they know that I deserve a better fate? I'm really much too young.
When your cousin Sandy told me you were coming to school in America, I said, Sandy, any cousin of yours is a cousin of mine.
Hey, you caught it. How tall are you? Never mind. We'll put high heels on your sneakers, and we'll make you a center.
Then I saw this angel hopping down the street. I said, hey, pretty baby, how's about a date?
Hello, boys.
Good morning, Miss Mason.
I would really love to see all of you in music appreciation this year, okay?
I'd like to see all of you in music appreciation this year.
You just might.
Oh, I think I'm in love.
It's better to play with a group than with yourself.
We're going prowling. We're going prowling. Tonight.
When is the best time of the month for a woman to conceive?
A night?
Reproduction. Reproduction.
Put your pollen tube to work.
Reproduction.
Reproduction. Make my steaming goby lurk.
Reproduction.
I don't think they even know what a pistol is.
I got your pistol right here.
I've missed my last two periods.
That's all right, dear. You can make them up after school.
Be when you grow up?
A burden on society.
Grease 2, the feeling goes on forever.
Would you be willing to give us a quick overview of what Grease 2 is about?
So much, yes. So in 1978, a film adaptation of the Broadway hit Grease was released to great commercial and critical success. It earned almost $400 million on a $6 million budget. So a sequel with a brand new crop of singing and dancing high school gang members just made sense. In 1982, we got Grease 2, brought to us by the same director, Patricia Barch. It was not as successful as the original. This go-around, the Pink Ladies are led by Stephanie Zanoni, played by young Michelle Pfeiffer, who knows how to spell, and the T-Birds are led by Johnny Nogarelli, played by Adrian Zmed, who had been very successful as Danny on Broadway and with the touring company of Grease. Other notable teenage gang members include Lorna Luft, Judy Garland's other daughter, Bobby Hill, also known as Pamela Adlon, Christopher McDonald, who many of us know and love as Shooter McGavin. Some returning cast members from the original film, including Dee Dee Kahn, who had played Frenchie, Sid Caesar, who was the coach, Eddie Deason, who was the nerdy sex pest, Eve Arden, and we also got the dreamiest of dreamy cool riders, Maxwell Caulfield. You also get to do one of my favorite things in this movie and play Spot Lucinda Dickey. There's a fake Lucinda Dickey and she'll trick you, but she's not Lucinda Dickey, it's the other one.
There she is. There she is. There she is.
Lucinda Dickey was Special K in the Breaking movies and was a super talented dancer, but could not sing to save her life. And so she's never featured in any of the production numbers. She's always either on the extreme left for some reason, or when there's a really complicated dance move happening, it's her because she's really fucking good. So Grease 2 features some huge production numbers, but not a lot of plot. Like, will Stephanie break free from Johnny's constant sexual harassment to find her very own cool rider? Will Paulette be happy with Johnny, who doesn't seem to respect her? Will Sharon and Rhonda find happiness in their situationships? Will Dee Dee Kahn's filmed but not used solo ever surface online? Will you be forever haunted by the Seagal twins? I think that we're supposed to really care about the high school talent show, but mostly now when I watch this movie, I just think about the heartbreaking end of the feminist origins of the Pink Ladies. Most of these songs are absolutely fucking terrible, and I know all the words. Grease 2.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Wendy. First of all, I'd be surprised if I didn't know the answer to this. Is this anybody's first time seeing this?
Yo.
Will, you had not seen this before. Okay.
I had not.
Yeah, excellent. All right. Wendy, what? And I and Dave, I know that, you know, this was also, basically, if Wendy hadn't picked this at some point, you would have.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Wendy,
this was just a racist who was going to get to pick it first.
Yeah, basically. Wendy, why did you pick this?
Oh, because this is a delightful movie. Plus, I love me a musical. But this is like such a special movie for me. But it absolutely is a terrible B movie that we get to talk about here. When I was a kid, we had HBO. And back in the very in the mid 80s, like, HBO would have maybe like 10 movies at a time, and they would just kind of show them on a loop. And for a while, they had Grease 2, and we got obsessed with it in my house. I love Grease 2. How often do I just kind of randomly sing Cool Rider lyrics at you?
At least once a month.
Yeah, that's your life.
Yeah, Grease 2 kind of qualifies under the crawl exemption. For this one.
I love that we have a name for it.
Yeah, I know. Because it did, in fact, have a much bigger budget. Not that you would know it, because it doesn't show up on screen, but it had a much bigger budget than the first Grease. And had the misfortune to come out in the summer of 1982, when the question was not, are you going to come in first that weekend? It's, who gets to come in second after E.T.?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Wendy. So, Dave, we'll just go right to you. Talk to us about Grease 2 and your relationship with that.
I honestly can't remember when I first saw it, but I know I have watched this way more than Grease 1. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the last time I've watched the original Grease. I think one of the things I enjoy about this film is it manages to be both a sequel and a parody of Greeks at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Johnny Dogarelli is like a parody version of Danny Zuko.
Yeah.
If you were going to make a version of Danny Zuko to take the piss out of him, you would create Johnny Dogarelli. Like, he's entirely about performative masculinity. He's not tough at all. He's a complete coward. He's essentially a theatre kid pretending to be a biker. Mm-hmm. And all that, but like the supporting cast, great. I mean, I love Christopher McDonald's Goose. Mm-hmm. Like Johnny's permanent shadow.
He's genuinely great in this.
Yeah, like he's like, even when he's not saying anything, he's in the background just stealing every scene he's in. Yeah, obviously, Michelle Pfeiffer has just got star quality for days. Like, even here, you can tell, like, yeah, this is someone who's meant for great things. Mm-hmm. She's kind of head and shoulders over a lot of people. And all, so, yeah, all the kind of supporting Pink Ladies and T-Birds are really fun. The only thing I sort of can't get over is Maxwell Caulfield, mm-hmm. who is, like... He's clearly not a very good singer because they bury his vocal tracks so far in the back of the mix. Because most of the songs, to be fair, most of the songs I don't think are in his register, mm-hmm. which is kind of a shame. But yeah, and like in Turn Back the Hands of Time, like because they've had to bury his voice in the back of the register, they've also had to do it to Michelle Pfeiffer, which just makes her sound weird as well. I mean, this is also essentially Batman the musical. Sort of well-to-do kids get secret identity as leather-clad Night Avenger and dates Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah,
that is in essence Batman. I mean, watching it again last night because both me and Julian love. It's one of the earliest films we bonded over that we both liked. And it's kind of, you know, watching it again this time around, it's kind of like, but there are some people who were in it from the previous film, but it makes it really weird that they are. Like, Eugene is back, and like Jenny would say, but he's a nerd. How is he still at high school? Surely he would have passed everything by now. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Bamuno is still kicking around with his genuine biker gang of street toughs.
Yeah.
Like harassing four idiots at a high school. Just sort of like, mate, if you've not got better things to be doing in your time. But yeah, I think like Tab Hunter's really good as a substitute teacher. I think he's a lot of fun. But while the songs may not be of the same quality as the original Grease, I think there are a couple of genuine bangers in there. Mm-hmm. Like the opening Back to School track, I think, is amazing. Girl for All Seasons isn't great, but it will stay in your head forever. Mm-hmm. So it's like, some of the songs aren't great, but they are catchy, you know, kind of really, it's going to earworm you kind of way that will possibly irritate me. But yeah, it's just like, a lot of it is just like, it's almost kind of taking the mickey out of Greece, especially considering, I thought about this time, that this film's set in 1961. Mm-hmm. So my first film was 1958, I think.
I think that's
first
right.
Grease was.
I think so.
So it's actually kind of like showing in a way, like, you know, even in 1961, like the whole kind of biker, like leather jacket biker craze had been moved on from. And so if anything, the T-Birds are sort of a weird, nerdy throwback to the original T-Birds rather than sort of genuinely being good because all the cool kids are going on to do other things. And of course, everybody looks like they're in their sort of mid-30s to early-40s, even though they're meant to be teenagers.
Right.
Like, one of the, like, that trio that sings Mr. Sandman, the guy in the glasses, I was looking at, how old is he?
Yeah.
It's like, that guy has a mortgage. But yeah, like, it's like, yeah, if you want a film, if you want something as good as Grease, this isn't it.
Yeah.
But if you want something that's silly, fun, doesn't take yourself too seriously, this is a good time.
Excellent. Awesome. Thanks, Dave. So, Will, this was your first time seeing this. What'd you think?
So, basically, my history is that Grease would play all the time on TBS whenever my sister and I would be over at my grandma's, because we didn't have cable at home, but she had cable. And then Grease 2 would often follow right after it. My sister would watch Grease, and then I'd get to watch something else because my sister just got the TV for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So I'd inevitably be like, okay, well, I'm seeing what's on Cartoon Network and watching that instead. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, I mean, it would be something probably really stupid, like, I don't know, Dream Patrol or something. But anyway, back to the point. I don't like Grease, the film, because, among other things, I know it's a case where the original musical was written as a parody of the 50s, of 50s nostalgia, and was very, like, anti that, and then for whatever reason, for the film, they were like, but what if we play it straight? And I think the film is worse for it. And then, watching Grease 2, it came to me that, okay, somebody was just like, okay, but what if we don't play it straight anymore? What if we're technically doing 50s nostalgia in the 60s, and that's ridiculous enough as it is, but what if we do a musical where any remotest amount of subtext is just, it goes out the window. Instead of, you know, having a song about a car, and then if you're paying attention to the lyrics, you realize, okay, yeah, no, this is a song about, you know, about having sex. What if we have a song that is called Scoring? At the bowling alley. That's what if we have a song just called Reproduction? What if we just throw all the context, the subtext out the window and just make it super text instead? And honestly, I think it works better for that. I mean, if this definitely does feel like somebody just went and said, hey, I saw the original Grease. What if we just play it up? Because, you know, the first one was a success. If we just play it bigger, okay, yeah. We have, like, you know, these really nice pink jackets in the original. What if they were wearing, like, pink shiny suede jackets instead now? Mm-hmm. What if they're driving around in a pink car? What if we have, like, a British guy who's going to dress up in just a leather jacket with no shirt for half the film, but the other half of the film, he is, like, just the stereotype of a stuffy British person, to the point where it's almost ridiculous. And that, I think, is why I ended up enjoying Grease 2 more than I've ever enjoyed Grease, because it's just so over the top in everything it does. That's like, I can't not enjoy the refuge and audacity of it all. Mm-hmm. And then also finding out that Maxwell Caulfield's married to Juliette Mills, who is Tabitha on Passions, was just a... was just the cherry on the cake.
It all comes back to Passions. Ain't nothing wrong with that. Thanks, Will. I'm basically there with everybody else. This movie is goofy as hell. And I can always get behind goofy as hell. When somebody starts singing, generally speaking, I inevitably find myself going, man, I wish I was watching the first one. But... because the music is just, as you say, Dave, it's some of the songs are catchy as hell, and I will never not have Reproduction rolling through my head ever again. That just pops in there from time to time anyway. But the songs, generally speaking, are pretty weak. That said, Back to School, yeah, Back to School is that's a pretty good song, not going to lie. But overall, yeah, I don't know that I've got a ton to say about this movie other than just the cast is, generally speaking, really good. I do wonder why they bothered bringing back anybody from the first Grease, because they don't have a whole lot to do in this other than, like, Eve Arden is doing the same Eve Arden thing that she was doing in the first one. Like, Dee Dee Cohn is wasted, which is a weird thing to say, but it's true.
I mean, she just disappears about halfway through the film, and no one ever talks about her again. Well, which makes me feel like they just realized, oh, we actually don't need you.
The only person she actually interacts with is Maxwell Caulfield. I mean, she might as well be a figment of his imagination. Maybe she is. Maybe when he doesn't need her anymore, she disappears. Like, again, Eddie Deason, why is Eddie Deason in this? As you say, he should have graduated by now. And also, did people think that they were going to, like, this isn't Grease if Eddie Deason's not in it?
Never underestimate the power of the Eddie Deason lobby.
Yes, exactly. I know. Well, Wendy is making a face. I know. It's not, you're not wrong. But I wonder if this might have been more successful if it had just been its own thing, honestly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, it has very, very little to do with the original Grease other than the setting.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, to be fair, if you're going to make a sequel to Grease, what else can you do, really, other than, you know, like, following Danny and Sandy's failing marriage? Yeah. You know, it's like...
They were trying to get Grease 3 to happen for the longest time. Like, the entire idea they had come up with was, okay, but what, we'll do a film that takes place in the 70s that's basically that is about, like, Danny and Sandy's daughter, and we'll get John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John to come back, and it just kept on falling through.
Yeah, they were working on that right up until Olivia Newton-John passed away. Like, they were desperately trying to bring that back.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is, people would have watched it. It would have been terrible, but people would have got to watch it.
Well, sure.
Yeah. But that's the thing I like about this. Is like, yeah, I mean, their main thing they're bringing to the table for this is they've just kind of like, let's take the Danny and Sandy relationship and flip the genders. Mm-hmm. So let's make, yeah, the guy the nerdy one and make the girl the cool one in the pink ladies.
Yeah.
Which, you kind of need to do a bit more with it than that, because it makes the kind of the sexual politics of it all a bit awkward.
But he's Motorcycle Batman.
Yeah, it's and the fact that no one can work out who he is. The fact is, like, even though he's in his cool rider getup, he still talks with a British accent.
Yeah,
it's like the whole bit where she's imagining him in Biker Heaven and stuff, because she thinks he's dead. And she's like, yeah, why am I imagining you with a British accent? Who else do I know that's British?
Yeah. And, like, it doesn't help that, like Wendy said, the pink ladies have been completely, you know, made enslaved to the T-Birds, apparently, in the last 3 years.
Yeah, welcome to the T-Birds, Maxwell Caulfield. You will now be assigned your pink lady.
That is some bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's at least one pink lady that's not completely adjacent to a T-Bird, so make it make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there was that bit there with Dolores, the young lass who's the wannabe pink lady. Mm-hmm. Who befriends Michael. She hooks up with Davey at the end, yeah. And me and Julie were like, no, Davey, you're going to jail.
Yeah, it's super gross. He's like 17, 18. She's what, 13, 14? No.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, Davey, you go to jail. You're going to the bad jail.
Like, best case scenario, she's 13, or 14, he's 17. It's not like no laws are being broken, but that is still fucking gross. That is the best case scenario.
He's got Nathan's birthday coming up, Danny.
Yeah. But, like, that said, Pamela Adlon is fantastic.
Oh, she's great.
Like, she's really, really good. Again, for a character that basically disappears halfway through the movie.
Yeah, I mean, basically her and Frenchie are only there to explain T-Bird and Pink Lady kind of, like, relationship dynamics to Michael.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, they're there to describe the social hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And then once they've done their job, off they go.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just the fact that, I mean, I do love the whole sequence of Michael slowly making enough money to buy a bike by selling essays to all the T-Birds and all the kind of clandestine meetups he has with each of them to exchange the work for cash.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really fun.
I love how he dumbs them down and intentionally misspells and sprays ink all over them so they look really bad, which is correct.
Yeah.
And then the fact that he gets enough money to buy a bike and, like, you know, he gets taken into kind of like, yeah, the bike junkyard, essentially. You go, oh, well, thank you. Thank you for this shell of a bike. I sure wish I knew about engineering so I could do it. It's all right, I've got a book.
He's got a book.
And Wendy, you pointed this out, too. This is like one of those things that would have passed me by, but you pointed this out, how in one scene he's barely able to make it 10 feet on a grass surface.
And then the next time, like two scenes later, he's the cool rider at the bowling alley.
Doing Evel Knievel jumps over cars.
Yep. But he's practiced loads in that one park.
That one time.
Going around, doing donuts around trees. It's fine.
And here's the thing, though. He does this all in the span of less than a month. Because I don't know what's going on with the weird time acceleration at Rydale High, but literally he shows up at the beginning of the school year, and it is obviously fall, but also we have an announcement early on that the talent show is in a month.
Mm-hmm.
So at most a month can happen. And then the day after the talent show is the big graduation luau followed by graduation. So... Yeah.
The thing that's happening in October is the talent show auditions.
So they spend the entire year working on this talent show?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the bullshit. They spent a year on this piece of shit talent show.
I think that they would have been a lot better if they'd been working on it for an entire year.
And the thing that makes me angry with the talent show is the Pink Ladies, the Calendar Girls, do so much work on that number, and they have so many elaborate costumes and changes. And it's so, they could have just bought the fucking records for what they spent on all of that.
Not only that, but they show up to audition and the set's already been partially built.
Yeah. That's not how any of that works.
Although I will say, fair play to David DiMucci, who pulled double duty between sort of doing their own performance with the T-Birds and then also learning all the costume changes and stuff for the Girl for All Seasons number as well. I mean, those guys put the work in.
They did.
And also, I got to think, like, you know, 100 LP records. In today's money, that is thousands of dollars. What, what school is going to just kind of have thousands of dollars worth of prizes just kind of sitting in there while their science lab needs whatever it needs?
Well, here's the thing. They don't actually tell them what the records are. As it turns out, they're probably just all like the exact same copy of like how to spell your ABCs.
Yeah.
Well, they've definitely got the best of Beethoven.
I imagine it's a load of stuff left over for the music department. Sadly, it's not the Roy Orbison albums that Goose is so fixated on.
Also, again, this has nothing to do with anything else. I spent the entire movie convinced that DiNucci was Niedermeyer. And I looked him up and he wasn't Niedermeyer, and I don't believe it. That man is that is Mark Metcalf. That is the master right there.
I think DiMucci is probably one of the better singers out the
Yes, he is. He absolutely is.
Yeah. I mean, like, Anthony Zement's fine, but like, yeah, I don't know. I never really kind of. he's just such a poser, and which is made more hilarious when you've got Goose, who's like twice the size of it.
He is.
And he's still handing stuff to him like he's his butler.
Adrian Zmed is a comically tiny man.
Yeah.
We looked it up, right?
Yeah.
And officially he's 5'8", but I don't think that's true. But in this movie, his boots are way higher heeled than everybody else's. And he has that ridiculous pompadour.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's clearly adding a couple of inches to the height already.
And they are, and Wendy, you also pointed this out, they are working so hard to not actually have him standing next to Christopher McDonald.
Oh, yeah, they're very careful.
Well, if they are, like, Christopher McDonald is back a couple of steps.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, but yeah, no, I mean, like, Goose is loads of fun. DiMucci, I mean, like, you don't see too much of DiMucci apart from the Do It For Our Country song, which obviously has a lot of undertones to it.
The date rape scene?
Are we calling those undertones?
Well, that's another thing too, because like the play, the musical play Grease, is a lot raunchier than the movie was, and yeah. I felt like this movie was kind of trying to bring that back into things, because there's a lot of like this movie skates pretty close to the edge on a lot of things like that.
Yeah, and the fact is, like, yeah, if they're all played by age-appropriate actors, it would be so much more creepy.
Yep.
Yes.
Like a genuine 17-year-old trying to wear sort of like the cool rider gear. Like, do you want to go for a ride? There's sort of massive helmet. It's like the Great Kazoo. Yeah.
And there's a line that Paulette said that she missed her last two periods, and.
No, it's not Paulette. It's the there's another girl that goes to see headmistress. Yeah, no, because it's a random girl they do for the gag, but it's not Paulette, sadly. Yeah.
For whatever reason, I thought it was Paulette, but okay, my bad.
Yeah, they don't quite go down the Rizzo route with it. But, yeah. But yeah, there are scenes of this, like you say, the whole Do It For Our Country number is essentially Dimitri pulling a date rape plot.
Yeah. We're going to fuck in this bowling alley.
Not great.
We're going to, make babies in science class.
They were going to dry hump in the bowling alley.
Ah, yes.
And they absolutely did do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's obviously the the tidal wave of cultural appropriation towards the end of the luau.
Oh my God, the luau.
I mean, Wendy, you remember the high school luau's?
Here's the thing. I think Rydell High is actually just a really rich school because, one, yeah, like you said, the 100 LPs, and the last one, they could afford a freaking carnival for the seniors. And in this one, they can afford a luau, including hiring a bunch of men in loincloths to carry people around into a pool.
Thank you, Robert Stigwood. Yeah. Yeah, there's an awful lot of open flame in the...
next to an awful lot of crepe paper.
Yeah.
And plastic grass skirts.
Yeah. Although, again, if nothing else... The luau scene gave us Lucinda Dickey just front and center kicking ass.
Because she's the best dancer they got.
She is the best dancer they got. Because the rest of the movie, as you said, like you said, Wendy, it's like, is that Lucinda Dickey or is that the girl that looks a lot like Lucinda Dickey? Which one is Special K? who among this crowd is Ninja 3?
You got to follow the Special K. She's the one spotting when she on her spins.
I got to say, I love that Lucinda Dickey has a grand total of 5 films to her resume, and we have watched 3 of them.
Yes. Challenge, accept it.
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely watch Cheerleader Camp.
I think the problem is, once you've watched Breakin' 2, how do you go back to Breakin' 1?
Well, let me see where it all began. The secret origin of Turbo and Ozone.
I mean, Breakin' 2 is so great because they don't bother with a plot. It's just a reason to have dance as opposed to there's a plot in here for some goddamn reason.
Probably. Yeah.
Actual character development instead of dancing to cure cancer.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to save the orphanage.
One thing I will say for this film is that there's lots of really fun, very minor one-scene characters. Mm-hmm. I think my favourite is probably the guy who's doing the overly passionate singing in the talent show, but he's just got falling over and he's just grabbing Johnny's leg when he's just so into it.
I was shocked when I found out that was Tom Villard, who is one of those actors who's just in everything, including Surf 2. He was Jocko in Surf 2.
But yeah, I thought that little scene was hilarious when Johnny gets pushed out by Paulette and he's just trying to get this guy off his leg like he's...
Yeah. And then once he's out there, Johnny won't go backstage.
Yeah.
That was funny.
I'm gonna say the headmistress knows the name of the T-Bird. She's getting it wrong on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then Connie Stevens as Miss Mason, the woman with no gaydar, but Like, she's hitting on Tab Hunter, who is obviously not interested and is just playing along by the end that he's interested, or those are my boys. So when the three guys are on stage who are obviously, okay, yeah, no, they're not your boys. They're each other's boys. I'm seeing how they're singing at each other. Thank you very much.
At one point, Wendy said, "Well, she's that's an awfully low neckline for a substitute for a teacher." And I think I said, "Yes, but for Connie Stevens, she's quite covered up."
It's on that bit when the headmistress first sort of sees Tab Hunter and her, and when she walks up, she just sort of like glances down at a cleavage halfway through and goes, "Oh no." Just sort of stops talking. Honestly, she is fantastic. Yeah. Like, she doesn't get to do much, but she's like, every scene she's in, she's entertaining.
Well, it's just like in the first one. I mean, she basically steals everything she's in.
Yeah.
But what I also like is that, you know, it gives her, she and Eve Arden are playing off of each other. Like, she's like, "Those are my boys." And then the T-Burst goes out, "Those are my boys."
And then her look of, like, her face lowering as it turns out the T-Birds are shit.
Yeah.
They're just making discordant noises and just jumping up and down. Until they get their act together, of course. Although, I do love that little scene where they're spying on the a cappella group. And you see, sort of like, everybody's heads come up slowly and then Davey comes up and you can just see the top of his head in his shorts.
He and Johnny are the same height.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Well, I mean, you know, the production could give Adrian Zemeta a box to stand on.
TJ Hooker's Adrian Zemeta. Yeah.
See, in my heart, he'll always be Dance Fever's Adrian Zemeta.
He's always Johnny to me.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's funny too, because as you said, he is a Broadway. He's a Broadway guy. He was the definitive Danny Zuko, and he's just not that here. Like he has charisma. I've seen him show it, but it's just not coming across in this movie for some reason.
But then Johnny's not supposed to be charismatic. Yeah. Like he's a doofus.
Yeah,
he's an idiot. again, this is something me and Jimmy were talking about a couple of days ago, but like in the first film, most of the T-Birds are actually idiots. The cool ones are Danny and Kinnicky.
Yeah,
like they are what make the T-Birds cool. You take them away, you just got a bunch of doofuses on motorbikes.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the version of the T-Birds in this is sort of that. Yeah. Like they haven't got a Danny or a Kinnicky, so sort of Johnny's just sort of filled the void by kind of like, you know, just more sort of just aggressively filling the role of biker as much as possible with, you know, the hair and the jacket and everything. But like, yeah, he's no Danny, but he's not supposed to be.
Okay, that's fair.
Like he's supposed to be this sort of pale imitation. And I think that's what Anthony Zemeta's playing. And I think in that regard, he does nail it because he's not meant to be anywhere near as cool as Dan.
That's fair. Because I guess you're right, because the T-Birds are not the leads in this movie.
No.
They're very much background characters.
Their background characters are antagonists for most of it.
Yeah. I also, if I recall correctly, in the original Grease, they don't actually have motorcycles at all. They have the car. And this is the movie where they get the motorcycles.
I think you might be right.
I think everybody thinks of Grease as a motorcycle movie, but it's not. It's a car movie.
Yeah.
I suppose so, because Grease Lightning's a car, isn't it?
And when they have the big race, it's the cars.
Yeah.
It's racing for pink slips, yeah.
I think Belmudo and his guys might have bikes, but the T-Birds don't.
They do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just that's how good Grease is at, like, creating this mystique, right? That, like, everybody remembers them on motorcycles, but they weren't. In this movie, they try to make them cooler and they give them the motorcycles and they just look like big doofuses. But, and you're absolutely right. Like, I think I've never really thought about the fact that the genders of the, like, the protagonist, like, the main couple are kind of reversed, right? And, yeah, the T-Birds are not the lead. They are the antagonists in this movie. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. All these times I've never really thought about it. I just get really angry about how the girls are treated and how the girls allow themselves to be treated.
Yeah. I mean, there is a little bit of kind of Paulette kind of taking things back towards the end, but it's kind of a bit too little too late, and you don't really get it for the, like, for the others.
Yeah. Like, there's definitely a feeling like Stephanie, once she graduates college, she's never talking to any of these people ever again.
Yeah.
I mean, high school.
I mean, the girls have her back when push comes to shove.
Yeah.
But they're very much... I'm going to talk about the rise of the Pink Ladies, mm-hmm. which was seen by, like, me and, like, one other person, maybe. Like, the Pink Ladies are founded maybe 10 years before the timeline of this movie. I don't have the exact date, but in The Rise of the Pink Ladies, Frenchie is the protagonist's little sister, and she's, like, junior high age. So, the Pink Ladies were started by girls who were outcasts and needed community and found one another. And they became a gang because everybody else called them a gang, because one of the members was a really talented fashion designer, and sewist who made them these beautiful Pink Lady jackets. It's been a while since I saw it, and you can't rewatch it because Paramount, like, chucked it. You can't find it anywhere. I think the T-Birds were somebody's brother's gang that they get involved with because the lead kind of falls for him, and it's this really, like, there's a whole racial element to it because they're she's of mixed race and her family's trying to pass for white, but they're, I think, Puerto Rican, and then there's the T-Birds, I think, are Latino. But it's very different, like, less than 15 years before this movie, like, the Pink Ladies are about empowerment and women supporting one another and taking care of each other and protecting each other. Flash forward to now, right, where, oh, what is that line about, like, you got to be a biker or a biker's old lady?
Yeah.
Right? Like, it goes with the jacket.
You gotta be T-Bird specifically.
Like, if you don't wanna, if you, like, you can leave the party, but leave your jacket at the door.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, like, the T-Birds control that. That is some serious bullshit.
Yeah. Because that's, yeah, because it's been a long time since I've seen Greece, but in Greece, they are just two separate gangs that, like, they hang out because a couple of them are dating, but they're not officially affiliated. There's not this Pink Ladies. Like, you know, are the sole purview of T-Birds.
Yeah, like the women's auxiliary.
Mm. Yeah. Like, I think that might actually be part of my problem with this film is probably the film that establishes that motorcycles as being cool is Easy Rider, mm-hmm. which is 1969. That's almost a full decade before this movie takes place, including the concept of the biker's old lady.
Well, like, I mean, you know, you had kind of that run of biker movies in the 50s, like The Wild One and you know, things like that. So that was definitely a thing in the 50s. But, yeah, like, the whole concept of, yeah, what you're saying, I mean, I'm not sure where I was going with that, Will, and I apologize, but... Yeah. That's, yeah, I think you're right. One of the things about this movie is it feels like almost like the producer, Robert Stigwood, just didn't understand his first movie. Like, when in doubt, make it bigger and goofier. And, like, this, like, Grease 1 is, like, produced by the Robert Stigwood that made Saturday Night Fever.
Right.
This one was done by the Robert Stigwood that made Tommy and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Like, just, it needs to be big, it needs to be splashy, it needs to be campy, it needs to be all this other stuff. Like, it's fun. I'm not gonna lie, it's a fun movie for what it is, but it does feel like he just, like, pick the surface stuff that, you know, this, you know, make this, take the surface stuff that made the first movie work and make it bigger.
Yeah, it's kind of telling that the next film he produced was Staying Alive.
Yeah. which, yeah, kind of the similar situation.
Yeah.
A film that couldn't even be bothered to realize the lyric is not staying alive, it's staying alive.
Yeah. And having said that, I will speak no ill against Tommy. Tommy rules. Okay.
I will say this for Grease, too. As someone who, like, there is a select few musicals that I genuinely enjoy. Mm-hmm. Like this, Singing in the Rain, obviously classic. Yeah. Little Shop of Horrors. But sort of, generally speaking, me and musicals tend not to like. But so the fact that I really, really like this probably says that it maybe isn't pitched as a traditional musical because I quite like it. Yeah. If that makes sense.
I think I get that, yeah.
Yeah, so a little, I appreciate it for that because, like, yeah, like, I mean, like I said before, it's just sort of like, yeah, if you want a truly great musical, go searching elsewhere because this isn't it. But this is kind of like a weird, dumb, fun, like, I mean, none of it makes a lick of sense at all. And I'm fine with that.
In the great tradition of American classics, we bring you Surf 2, the end of the trilogy. The surf wars continue when a mad genius pollutes innocent surfer youth and the free beaches of America.
Do you know how many brain surgeons, nuclear physicists, or Nobel laureates have been surfers? I'll tell you, none.
It's a sprawling surf saga of rebellion, romance,
I'm Bob.
Adventure beneath boiling seas, struggle against uncontrolled substances, and a race to the death by freedom fighters protecting your right to surf and the American way.
Must be from L.A.
Surf 2, with music by the Stray Cats, Oingo Boingo, Split Ends, the Circle Jerks, the Beach Boys, and more. Surf 2, the adventure that dares to trash school, police, parents, the beach itself, and the two greatest American institutions of all time.
Don't stop innocent kids from drinking cola and surfing. It's the American way.
It's the final confrontation of the Surf Wars trilogy. If you missed Surf 1, you owe it to yourself to see Surf 2.
Punks and creeps. I think these guys would be mature enough to take surfing seriously.
It's twice the fun of Surf 1. Surf 2.
So next up, we paired this with the classic among classics, Surf 2. This actually has multiple tie-ins to Grease 2, in that it is, well, one, it stars Sir Edward Deason in his very first top billing role. It is also a sequel in name only. In two ways, actually, which I did not realize at first. One, it is, you know, there is no Surf 1. And two, it was re-released under the name Surf 2, The Nerds Strike Back, in a hope that people would think it was a sequel to Revenge of the Nerds. Oh. What is this movie about? Excellent question.
You got me.
Okay, basically, so Eddie Deason is a mad scientist who plots his revenge against all the people that made fun of him in high school. His greatest enemies are the surfers, so he creates this thing called Buzz Cola, which turns surfers into zombies. Meanwhile, there's surfers. That's basically it.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, you know? This movie is a different movie depending on what scene you're watching and who's in the center of it. Is it a beach movie? Is it a parody? Is it a Zucker Brothers movie? Your guess is as good as mine. But there's a little of everything in this movie. I'm going to hold off with my thoughts for a minute. Wendy, I'm actually going to start with you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Well, first of all, nobody had seen this movie before. Is that correct?
God,
just me.
No. It's just you, Wendy. So why don't you tell me about this movie and your history with it?
I mean, as I think that I've mentioned before, like, I could just rent whatever I wanted at the video store, and we absolutely rented Surf 2 a few times. one of my enduring lifelong crushes is Eric Stoltz. And we're like, oh, Eric Stoltz is in this. Kind of. I mean, he's in it, yes. But it is not an Eric Stoltz movie. And so I've definitely seen it a bunch of times. But, I mean, it's bad, right? Like, to the point where I, in my head, I mix this movie up with Surf Nazis Must Die, even though it's absolutely a very different movie tonally. It's just the surf nonsense and the bad movie. I just kind of lump them together. I usually have a lot to say, right? I got nothing. They're laughing because I'm making the face in the screen. Like, I don't know what else to say about Surf 2. Like, there's not a lot of movie there.
You haven't actually talked about what you think of it.
What do I think of it? I think it's
You said it was bad. I mean, I don't think
it's as bad. It's as much garbage as the garbage that the surf zombies eat in the gross out scene, right? I think that everything that you said is right. Like, what the hell is this movie? Is it a surf movie? Is it a boner comedy? Is it... what the fuck is it, right? And really all it is maybe an excuse to assemble a really cool soundtrack and hire Danny Elfman to write, I think, his first original movie song?
I think that's right, yeah.
Right? That's kind of all this movie is, you know? It's got some interesting cast members in it. Again, like, I will always watch an Eric Stoltz movie. It's got, you know, Tom Villard is funny in it as Jocko. I like him anyway. Corinne Bohr is in it as one of the interchangeable girlfriends, Cindy Lou. You know, she would later go on to star on ER with George Clooney.
But not that ER.
But the other ER, that's the joke. You know, TV's Ron Palillo, right? Ruth Buzzy as a mom. But it's just not a great movie, and there's so much Eddie Deason in it, right? There's too much. The Eddie Deason factor is too high in this movie, and even then, like, we're like, he's like a one note actor, right? And good for him for like finding his type and like getting a lot of work as that type. But knowing what we know now about Eddie Deason, like, it's just uncomfortable to see this much Eddie Deason. No, like.
Yeah, he's definitely made some headlines in the last few years, although, you know, not excusing any of it. He's absolutely not okay, the things that he's been doing. You know, he's also very publicly struggling with severe mental illness, which, again, does not excuse any of it, just maybe explains a little bit of it.
It doesn't. But, I mean, it's a reason to get help. Mm-hmm. It's not a reason to harass women.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Like, if you won't leave the nursing home, then you need to talk to somebody who can maybe prescribe something for you. But yeah. Okay. Will, how about yourself? Tell me what you were thinking about this.
It's all over the place. Yeah. Like, the humor, especially when it misses, it is like terribly bad. When it's spot, there are multiple times though where the humor I felt was spot on, and I was actually kind of just, I was laughing at it just because of how absurdly stupid it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, not half the characters just exist to deliver jokes, and their characterization will change from one scene to the other. Like, oh, is the principal a authoritarian, or is he, just kind of, the goofy principal who likes his students surfing? Are the wives? Do they care about their sons, or do they just care about about being horny for their husbands who are evil businessmen? And then you get to the plot where literally it's like, this is the ultimate underwear gnomes plot. Because it's literally just turn surfers into surf zombies, ? But then even further than that, ?
Yeah, I know that they say that this is all about making the dads a lot of money, but I'm not entirely certain how that works.
Well, in theory, they're in theory, nobody was drinking Buzz Cola to begin with. And then they ended up deciding, okay, we're going to make it really cheap by producing it at a petroleum factory. And then, but nobody's going to even drink it then. So now we have to make it really, really cheap by then adding on a dollar fee to even drink it. And then we're going to make people zombies who are addicted to it. And if they don't drink it, then they're just drinking petroleum. It's like I said, the movie is completely stupid beyond all belief. And yet there is a charm when it's good, it's charming.
Okay.
Well, there's a charm to it. Mm-hmm. It's not charming itself, but when it's bad, it is pretty bad to the point where there's towards the end of it, it's like, here comes some naked terrible transphobia. Great. Mm-hmm. That's what I needed at the end of my movie.
But that's definitely a thing. Okay. All right, Dave, hit me. What
you got? Okay, so full disclosure, the stream I was watching this on cracked out on me about an hour and 10 minutes in. But yeah, I tried to get it restarted, couldn't get it going in time. But if nothing else, it came as blessed relief. this is awful. Like it is a series of non sequiturs. Like, almost completely unrelated scenes were it not for the same actors being in most of them. Like, it has no plot. It's pretending it has a plot, it doesn't have a plot. Everybody's performing in a completely different movie. I mean, like, pretty much the only high point for me was spotting Lyle Wagner from Wonder Woman turning up in it. But like, there are scenes in this that are just genuinely grossly unpleasant to watch. I was bored. I was disengaged. This is a film with no redeeming features. I have no idea what it was trying to achieve. Like, there's occasional flashes of nudity in this, but it's about as unerotic or titillating as you can possibly get. Like, it was just sort of like, fine, okay, there were some boobs. Mm-hmm. I don't care. For the novelty factor of seeing an early Eric Stoltz film, vaguely interesting, but this is a film with no redeeming qualities. It's an absolute mess. It's inconsistent from scene to scene. It does things without any reason. Like the whole sort of, the two kids having identical households who say the same thing sort of side by side to each other felt like it was I don't know why. It was an interesting thing that it must have taken a while to coordinate, but what's it doing? What's it saying? It's just there. And then it comes back again, and then eventually they just sort of stop bothering to do it. It's just kind of like, this is shit.
Okay. That is fair. So I first of all, I will agree that this is not the best, not a great movie. It's not. I am kind of with Will in that I do find a lot of charm in it. It is very confusing, in part because it is so tonally all over the place. Like, every character seems to be in a different movie. Like, the big head bow guy is right out of a boner comedy. Like, that is straight up mid-80s, over the top, nonsense.
You got the meathead kind of Pluto Gutowski from Wish. Kind of
exactly. And he's driving around in the video game and shit like that. Like, that's exactly that kind of movie. Then you've got Lyle Wagner and TV's Horseshack, who are basically almost in a Zucker Brothers movie. His name is Chief Boyardee because he's the police chief. It's that kind of thing. And the rest of the movie it's a parody of beach movies, which I get, and I don't mind it. There is a lot of, there's some gross out humor, which I don't love. The scene on the beach with Big Head and Tom Villard just eating garbage was really kind of tough to sit through. But there's a lot of, for me, again, I know that I'm kind of on out in the weeds on this. There's a lot of people doing fun work. Eric Stoltz is, it's really funny to me to watch Eric Stoltz, capital A, act in this movie. Like he's playing Diet Spicoli, but he's underplaying it in a way that everybody else is over the top. You know, like he's very much about the, like the little looks and the gestures and the eye movements and things like that. Whereas everybody else is just overdoing it. And it's really kind of weird to see. It's fun for me to see Corinne Bohrer, you know, because I'm of the generation that remembers when she was, you know, every few years there's an actress who Hollywood seems to be trying to make happen. Like they're on like three sitcoms in 4 years. And then like they're trying, and eventually they just move on to the next one. So she's kind of like the Paula Marshall of the late 80s, early 90s, you know, or the Ashley Williams. Cause I have a lot of fondness for her, and it was fun to see her in this. And it was actually nice to see the girls actually do things in this movie to a certain extent. Like they weren't the lead characters by any stretch, but they actually did occasionally have stuff to do. For me, the only thing that I will agree that Eddie Deason is not a lead actor and should not be given lead roles. I don't know. It's not a good movie. I'm not going to pretend that it is. It's just, I do find a lot of charm to it though. It knows, yeah, as incoherent as it is, it knows kind of what it wants to be, and it is that movie. You know, your mileage may vary, and I get that. So, it was also one of those things where it's like, we haven't done an 80s boner comedy, which is like a staple of the type of movie that we watch, the B movie. But it's a boner comedy that, for the most part, does not have a ton of misogynist, like overtly misogynist or sexual assault material in it, you know, which is why it's been hard to find a boner comedy, because they are rife with that kind of thing. You know, I find this movie to be fun. It's not good. It's a very much a USA Up All Night movie. In fact, that is where I first saw it. It was on USA Up All Night. And then, you know, A Tale as Old as Time, you know, it disappeared, but then the Alamo Drafthouse discovered it. And that has kind of turned it into very much a cult film that people enjoy, to the extent that Quentin Tarantino saw it and started programming it at the New Beverly.
And then Vinegar Syndrome released a director's cut, which is what we watched.
It is. We did watch that, because the theatrical cut was like, this was the movie that I guess the director gave to his producers. And the distributor was like, nope, needs more boobs, needs more gross out humor, needs less Dick Dale. So they made those changes. And, you know, I did not necessarily need more boobs and more gross out humor and less Dick Dale. So yeah, we watched the original version.
Cleveland Little's in this film, mm-hmm. and I can only assume he was blackmailed into it, because he's acting like he's there under duress. He's very much like, I don't know what the level below phoning something is, mm-hmm. but like that's like he's there. He's saying things, but he clearly couldn't give a shit.
It's funny too, because I found him to be genuinely funny. Like his line deliveries, and I think it maybe was because he was just so not into being there. But I did find what he was doing to be very funny most of the time. Although to be fair, Cleavon Little was an extremely talented actor who lifts everything he's in, but also was one of those like Michael Caine types that never said no to anything. he's in a lot of bad shit.
Yeah, I mean, like his opening scenes were kind of okay, but then there's that scene in the morgue where he just keeps repeating things and then passing out, and it just kind of, like, just felt like, was that either the direction he was taking or what? But, like, it's like, I know he's better than this. Like, I've seen Blazing Saddles. I know he's better than this, mm-hmm. especially if you give him the material to back him up. And it just kind of felt like they somehow got Cleveland Little in their film, but just didn't use it. like, well, certainly not enough. Sort of like, you've got Cleveland Little. Why are you showing me Edward Deason?
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, again, that scene in the morgue, I actually found what he was doing. I actually laughed at what he was doing. It almost felt like something he himself was throwing in. You know? But I hear what you're saying, and I'm not going to disagree with you.
I mean, like, yeah, obviously, yeah. I think all of us have those films that, for whatever reason, we saw them at the right time, mm-hmm. that we personally kind of connected to them. Mm-hmm. And, well, yeah, I've got plenty of films like that,
sure.
which I know other people have seen and not enjoyed, and, like, yeah, I get it. It's just kind of like, yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about, Dave. Every single film that I love, everyone else loves.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, obviously, Will, you are the obvious exception to this. Where every film you've ever selected has been nothing but gold.
Oh, yeah.
I remember sort of saying so every time we do this. It's like, Will, your decisions are fantastic. Yeah. Why don't we just let Will pick every week? I'm offered her train.
I really look forward to when it's Will's turn.
Oh, man. I would like to talk a little bit about the soundtrack, because the soundtrack is fucking amazing. Like, this is one of those movies where you watch the trailer and, like, a good third of it is, wow, look at all these bands we've got to put music in our movie. like when you mentioned, like, it's got an original Oingo Boingo song, but it's also got, like, Split Ends and Talk Talk and multiple Beach Boys tracks.
Yeah. I'm just watching it, and I'm like, wait, is that Mexican radio? Oh, mm-hmm. my God, that's mm-hmm. Mexican radio playing.
Yeah, she and blood. The Stray Cats and the Circle Jerks. Thomas Dolby.
Yeah.
She blinded me with science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I think the ideal way to experience this film in many ways is just to find the Spotify playlist of the soundtrack and just enjoy the music. Because yeah. the music's excellent. The music's... I can't fault the score.
The music is really, really good.
Apparently, the Oingo Boingo song has never actually been released outside the soundtrack.
And the soundtrack was never released.
Yeah.
Like they said, like the credits actually said that, you know, Capitol Records was going to put the soundtrack out. But apparently when your movie loses all kinds of money, Capitol Records doesn't put a soundtrack out. Which actually is a shame, because this would have been a great album. Hmm. You know, lots of surf music, obviously, you know, lots of punk, lots of new wave, even some ska. I mean, it's kind of all over the place, but it's a lot of fun.
Somebody somewhere's probably done the Spotify.
Oh, I have to assume so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to assume so.
Somebody would have thrown that together. So there's always someone nerdy enough for that sort of thing. And fair play.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, that Oingo Boingo song that didn't get released, that's a damn shame, because I love that song. I think it's a great song, but you know, hey, what are you going to do? Again, your movie doesn't make money. You don't get a lot of ancillary merch.
Which, side note, the you mentioned the punks, like the zombie punks, their costumes are basically just rubber. And I'm like, I don't know if that's something that they just watch, like the Road Warrior, and were like, those are punks.
There's a bit at the start when, like, the two surfers are in the sea, and that like, ring of lights comes up from underneath them, and I thought, oh, right, so it's probably like aliens or something. And it's not; it's just Eddie Deason.
Yeah, in his underwater lair.
And I'm like, because for a second I had a spark of hope of, oh, right, maybe this is like a dumb kind of alien invasion parody of, you know, like sort of combining those two kind of 50s genres of beach movies and sort of like sci-fi invasion stuff. Like that, I would have been quite on board for. But yeah, no, it wasn't that. I mean, I guess maybe that's one of those things that, like, you know, you do see little hints of stuff that could have been good if it was consistently followed through on. And if you just sort of stitch those, like, yeah, if you took those bits and sort of stitched them together better, you probably could have had something quite fun. But again, because, like, it can't decide on the tone, it can't decide on the plot. But it's kind of like, it is a throw everything at the wall, see what sticks kind of situation. Like, look, it always feels like almost like a sketch film, or like, you know, like Kentucky Fried Movie or something. You know, they've kind of thrown a lot of kind of very, very loosely connected scenes up on the screen, and like any sketch kind of thing, sort of like, you know, things like something's loud or something's going.
You know, yeah, honestly, you're probably right. That might have worked a little better if they didn't have the whole Buzz Cola zombie scenario happening. And yeah, those zombies were straight out of Trauma. Like, yeah. You know, which I'm not faulting, you know, I can, you know, there is a mood I can be in to, you know, appreciate Trauma.
It doesn't come around very often. When it does,
when it does, nothing else will do. You know.
So, because Danny owns the Vinegar Syndrome release, we watched a bonus feature in which they interviewed the costume designer, and she talked a little bit about those costumes. So, she was not the original costume designer. She was brought in less than 2 weeks before the start of filming to replace a costume designer that was not working out. And just kind of went a little bit mad buying all those wetsuits and then trying to make them costumey. I kind of thought that they looked vaguely like the undeads from Phantom of the Paradise. Like they have that, like, they had that like German expressionist influence mixed in with like weird popular perception of what punk fashion looked like at the time, which looked kind of like that. And I love that their hair is dyed with like what is very plainly that like spray in hair color that you buy at CVS for your Halloween costume, because that's what the real punks do.
Funny you should say that, because about the German expressionism thing, because when they first popped up in the background when the two guys were in the basement, it was just like, oh, well, Kraftwerk had turned.
Exactly, yeah.
And I love that the fashion designer, the costume designer, you know, mentioned it turns out it's a really bad idea to cut holes in wetsuits.
Oh yeah, no, I noticed at least one point I was like, I see a guy's ass.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the more subtle appearances of an ass in this film.
Oh god.
I mean, I think you see more men's asses than you see boobs.
You do. That first ass that you see is like another centimeter, and this would have been NC-17.
Oh my
god. Like that was that was upsetting. That was not expected.
Dear God. Like, I used to work in care. I've seen some stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't mind telling you, and that was still traumatic.
Yeah. So, sorry?
It's not often somebody else has to apologize.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, yeah, but we all have our misses as well as our hits.
Yeah. And honestly, like I said, I can see myself showing this to people at a bad movie night. So, sure. I mean, honestly, this, I had some fun with it. It's just also then occasionally has these points where it bears into why are we in this scene? Mm-hmm. Can we get back to the weird off? Can we get back to the guy just randomly getting an ambulance car? Honestly, anything. Oh, just about anything where it involved, Johnny Big Head, I was entertained by. Just at the end, the entire ending of the plot revolves around the fact that they just forget to turn him into a zombie. Mm-hmm. Or it just doesn't stick, I guess.
Yeah.
And he just goes around and starts randomly breaking things to the point where I'm like, are you even aware of what you're doing? Or are you... Did they just decide we're running out of film? So, yeah, Johnny Big Head starts breaking the set and turns the zombies off.
Mm-hmm.
I am always delighted for an opportunity to be reminded of how much I enjoy Eric Stoltz.
Yeah. That was a not zero factor in picking this movie. I'm not going to lie.
I think he's good.
Oh, he's great.
I've got no criticism of Stoltz.
He's acting in this movie.
He's one of the few people who appears to give a shit.
Yeah, he was one of the things in the one season of Caprica that I enjoyed.
And this is his second movie. In his first movie, he was basically a Spicoli friend who stumbled high out of a van. I don't know if he even had any lines in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And he's one or two movies away from making Mask at this point.
That's a film that's not at all like I expected. None of the toys from the original toy line in there. Like...
Oh my God!
And at no point does a car turn into an airplane. I was deeply disappointed.
Mask. It's
very confused.
G.I. Joe driving Transformers. It's genius. Take my money.
Sorry.
No, you're right. You're not wrong. I distinctly remember being 10 years old and being disappointed when I heard that they were making a Mask movie. That wasn't what it was about.
Why are you putting Cher in my Mask movie? Oh, because that's
all right. Are we good? We're good.
I think we're good. Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you for being here. Thank you for putting up with me. Thank you. Thank you, faithful listeners. We love you. We enjoy you. Please take care of yourselves. Drink some water. Go to bed.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show was presented by Wendy Abramo, Will Ackerman, Dave Probert, and DJ Toland. Next time, we'll be doing a staged reading of my screenplay for Citizen Kane 2, The Ninja Strikes.
To be fair, this movie isn't the greatest movie ever, but damn it, I still enjoy it. It's kind of what this podcast is all about.
Yeah.
So I can absolutely get behind that.